The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 3, Continued. Cassette 12, Side 2.
How sad that the young enthusiast did not live to see the triumph of his noble ideas. The precious lines in the newspaper blurred, swam. Vasiliev's daughter tore the newspaper out of its case, pressed it to her breast, and carried it off, with a militiaman blowing his whistle after her. While this was going on, the young enthusiast was sitting in a damp cell in the Verkhny Uralsk isolator. Rheumatism, or some sort of bone disease, had bent the old man double, and he could no longer straighten his spine. Luckily, he was not alone in the cell, but shared it with some Swede or other who had cured his spinal trouble by massage. Swedes are not very often found in Soviet jails. I remember that I, too, had been in with one of them. His name was Erik. "Erik Arvid Andersen?" V.A. eagerly interrupted. He was very quick in his speech and movements. Of course, it had to be. It was Arvid who had massaged him back to health. A reminder from the archipelago by way of farewell that it's a small world after all. So that was where they had taken Arvid 3 years ago, to the Uralsk isolation prison. And somehow or other neither NATO nor his multimillionaire papa had made much of an effort to save the dear lad. Pavel Veselov, Stockholm, was now studying other cases of Swedish citizens seized by the Soviet authorities, puts forward the following hypothesis after analyzing E.A. Anderson's stories about himself. Both his appearance and the form of the name which he gave make it more probable that E.A. Anderson was a Norwegian, but for reasons of his own preferred to pass himself off as a Swede. It was much commoner for Norwegians to escape from their country after 1940 and serve in the British Army, though a very few Swedes may have done so. E.A. might have been related to some Robertsons in Britain, but invented a relationship with General Robertson to make himself more valuable in the eyes of the MGB. It is not impossible that he had served in West Berlin after the war in Allied military intelligence, which was what made him interesting to the MGB. He had probably visited Moscow as a member of a British or Norwegian, not a Swedish, delegation. There was, I believe, no such Swedish visit at the time, but was probably a person of minor importance in it. Perhaps the MGB invited him to become a double agent, and perhaps it was for refusing this offer that he got his 20 years. Erik's father may have been a businessman, but not on such a large scale as he claimed. However, Erik often exaggerated, among other things, his father's acquaintance with Gromyko, which is why the MGB showed him to Gromyko, to interest the MGB in the idea of demanding ransom, and so letting the West know of his plight. Meanwhile, they had started calling us into the Oblast command post, which was right there on the MVD yard, and consisted of a colonel, a major, and several lieutenants who were in charge of all exiles in Jambul Oblast. We, however, had no access to the colonel, while the major only scanned our faces as though they were newspaper headlines, and it was the lieutenants who exercised their beautiful penmanship on the task of processing us. My camp experience gave me a sharp nudge in the ribs. Look out. In these few short minutes your whole future is being decided. Don't waste any time. Demand. Insist. Protest. Rack your brains. Turn yourself inside out. Invent some reason, any reason, why you must at all costs remain in the Oblast capital, or be sent to the nearest and most convenient district. There was, in fact, a good reason, although I did not know it. Secondary growths had been developing in me for 2 years now since my incomplete operation in the camp. No, I was not the man I had been, no longer the man I had been when I started serving my sentence. A sort of inspired immobility came over me, and I pleasurably abandoned myself to it. I enjoyed not making use of my importunate camp experience. I loathed the thought of improvising some wretched, poverty-stricken excuse. No human being can know the future. The greatest of disasters may overtake a man in the best of places, and the greatest happiness may seek him out in the worst. Anyway, I had not even had time to ask questions and find out which were the good and which the bad districts in the oblast, because I had been preoccupied with the fate of the old engineer. There was some sort of saving clause in his papers, because they allowed him to go into the town on his own 2 feet, walk to the Oblast Irrigation Construction Office and ask for work. For the rest of us, there was only one destination, the Kok Terek district. This is a patch of desert in the north of the oblast, the beginning of the lifeless Betpak Dala, which occupies the whole center of Kazakhstan. So much for the grapes we had dreamed of. A form printed on coarse brown paper was put before each of us for signature, after his name had been entered in a flowing hand and the date stamp applied. Where I met something similar, of course, when they informed me of the special board's decision. Then, too, nothing had been asked of me but to take the pen and sign. Only then it was smooth Moscow paper. The pen and ink, though, were just as cheap and nasty. Of what, then, had I been this day informed? That I, the person herein mentioned, was exiled in perpetuity to such and such a district under the open surveillance, that old Tsarist terminology, of the district MGB, and that in case of unauthorized departure beyond the borders of the district, I should be charged under a decree of the Presidium of the Supreme Soviet, providing for a penalty of 20 years of imprisonment with hard labor. What was there to say? It was all perfectly legal. There were no surprises for us here. We signed with alacrity. Years later, I would get hold of the criminal code of the RSFSR and read with great satisfaction under Article 35 that sentence of exile was passed for terms from 3 to 10 years, or by way of supplementary punishment after imprisonment, for up to 5 years. This is a source of pride to Soviet jurists, that with the 1922 criminal code, loss of civil rights and all other penalties for an indefinite term ceased to exist in Soviet law. Except for the most terrifying penalty of all, expulsion forever from the territory of the USSR. There is here an important difference of principle between Soviet and bourgeois law. See the collection of articles from the prisons. This is as may be, but to save the MVD labor, the simplest thing is to write out a perpetual sentence. There is then no need to watch out for sentences near expiry and worry your head looking for a way to renew them. It also says in Article 35 that no one is exiled except by special order of the court, or of a special board at least, but it was not even a special board. It was merely the lieutenant on duty who prescribed perpetual exile for us. An epigram gradually took shape in my mind. Rather a lengthy one, I must admit. Mere paper, with a hammer's speed, it shatters frail hopes of a kinder fate. Exiled eternally, I read, with the MGB to keep watch on the gate. Yet I sign with a flourish, my heart is light, like the Alps, the basalts, or the firmament, like the stars, no, not those on your shoulder so bright. O enviable lot, I am permanent. But can it, I wonder, be every word true? Can the MGB really be permanent, too? When Vladimir Alexandrovich got back from town, I read him my epigram and we laughed. Laughed like children, like prisoners, like innocents. V.A. had a very happy laugh, like that of K.I. Strakovich. There was, in fact, a profound similarity between them. They were people who had withdrawn so deeply into the life of the mind that no bodily suffering could upset their spiritual equilibrium. Not that he had much to laugh about even now. They had made one of the mistakes expected of them, and exiled him, of course, to the wrong place. Only Frunze could assign him to the Chuisk Valley, to the sites of his earlier work. Here the Hydraulic Engineering Authority was concerned only with irrigation channels. Its head, a smug, semi-literate Kazakh, graciously permitted the creator of the Chuisk irrigation system to stand in the doorway of his office, telephoned regional party headquarters, and consented to take V.A. on as a junior hydraulic engineer, as though he were a little girl fresh from technical school. But to Frunze he could not go. It was in a different republic. Shall we sum up the whole history of Russia in a single phrase? It is the land of smothered opportunities. Still, the grey old man rubs his hands. His name is known to scientists. Perhaps they will get him transferred. He, too, signs the document stating that he is exiled in perpetuity, and that if he absconds, he will be sentenced to hard labor until he is 93. I carry his things as far as the gate, the boundary line which I am forbidden to cross. Now he will look for someone kind enough to rent him one corner of a room, and he threatens to send for his old woman from Moscow. His children? His children wouldn't come. They say that they cannot give up their Moscow apartments. Any other relatives? He has a brother, but his brother's lot has been a profoundly unhappy one. He is a historian who misunderstood the October Revolution, abandoned his homeland, and now, poor wretch, has the chair of Byzantine studies at Columbia University. We laugh again, feel sorry for his brother, and embrace as we say goodbye. Yet another remarkable man has flashed by me and vanished forever. The rest of us were for some reason kept for days in a tiny room, sleeping close-packed on a rough, cracked floor with scarcely room to stretch our legs out. It reminded me of the lock-up in which I had begun my sentence 8 years before. Discharged prisoners now, we were locked in for the night and told to take the latrine pail inside if we wanted it. It differed from jail only in that for the first few days we were no longer fed free of charge, but had to pay for food to be bought from the market. On the third day, a regular escort party with carbines arrived, made a sign for our travel money and rations, promptly took the travel money from us again, allegedly to buy tickets, but in reality they bullied the train conductors into letting us travel for nothing and kept the money, considering that they had earned it, lined us up two by two with our belongings, and led us once more between the rows of poplars to the station. Birds were singing, the hum of spring was in the air, and it was only March the 2nd. We felt hot in our padded clothes, but we were glad to be in the south. Others may have different views, but for prisoners and exiles the greatest of hardships is severe cold. For a whole day we were carried slowly back in the direction from which we had come. Then, from the station at Chu, we were hurried along on foot for 10 kilometres. Our sacks and cases made us sweat profusely, weighed us down, caused us to stumble. But still we dragged them along. Our miserable carcasses might yet be grateful for every last rag carried out through the camp guardhouse. I was wearing 2 padded vests, one I had pinched during stock-taking, plus my long-suffering army greatcoat, worn threadbare by the earth of the trenches and that of the camp. How could I throw the faded, grimy old thing away now? Day was ending, and we had not reached our destination. This meant spending yet another night in jail at Novotroitsk. We had been free for such a long time, and still we went from jail to jail. The cell, the bare floor, the peephole, use the bucket. Hands behind your backs, here's your hot water. The only thing they leave out is our rations, because we are free men now. In the morning they sent up a lorry, and the same escort, after a night out of barracks, came to fetch us. 60 kilometres farther into the steppe. We got stuck in muddy hollows and jumped down from the lorry, something we could not have done as Zeks, to heave and push it out of the mire, to get the eventful journey over and arrive in perpetual exile more quickly. The escort troops stood in a half-circle and kept guard over us. The steppe sped by, kilometre after kilometre. To right and left, as far as the eye could see, there was nothing but harsh grey, inedible grass, and only very occasionally a wretched Kazakh village framed with trees. At length the tops of a few poplars, Kokterek means green poplar, appeared ahead of us over the curve of the steppe. We had arrived. The lorry sped between Chechen and Kazakh adobe huts, raising a cloud of dust and drawing a pack of indignant dogs in pursuit. Amiable donkeys with little carts made way for us, and from one yard a camel turned slowly and contemptuously to look at us. There were people, too, but we had eyes only for the women, those unfamiliar, forgotten creatures. Look at that pretty dark girl in the doorway, shading her eyes with her hand to watch our lorry pass. Look at those three walking together in flowery red dresses. Not one of them Russian. This is all right. We shall find wives for ourselves yet. This cheerful shout in my ear came from V.I. Vasilenko, a 40-year-old sea captain who had lived an untroubled life in Ekibastuts, in charge of the laundry, and was now on his way to freedom to spread his cramped wings and look for a ship. past the district stores, the tea room, the clinic, the Soviet offices, the district party headquarters with its slated roof, the House of Culture under its reed thatch. Our lorry stopped near the MVD-MGB building. Covered with dust, we jumped down, went into its front yard, and, unembarrassed by passers-by in the main street, washed ourselves down to the waist. Directly across the street from the MGB stood an amazing building, one story yet quite high. Four Doric columns solemnly upheld a false portico. At the foot of the columns were two steps faced with smooth stone, and over all this there was a blackened straw roof. My heart could not help beating faster. It was a school. A 10-year school. Stop pounding. Be quiet, you nuisance. That building is nothing to you. Crossing the main street to the magic gate goes a girl with waved hair, neatly dressed in a little wasp-waisted jacket. Surely she is walking on air. She is a teacher. She is too young to have graduated from an institute. She must have attended a 7-year school and then a teacher's training college. How I envy her. What a gulf there is between her and a common labourer like me. We belong to different estates, and I would never dare to walk arm in arm with her. Meanwhile, someone was yanking the new arrivals into his quiet office one by one and busying himself with them. Who, would you think? Why, Godfather, of course, the secret police officer. You find him in the land of exile, too. There, too, he plays the leading role. The first encounter is very important. We shall be playing cat and mouse with him not just for a month, but in perpetuity. Now I shall cross his threshold, and we will discreetly look each other over. He is a very young Kazakh. He wears the mask of polite reserve, and I wear that of artlessness. We both know that our insignificant phrases such as, "Have a sheet of paper," and "Is there a pen I can use?" are the beginning of a duel. But it is important for me to pretend that I haven't the slightest idea of this. It must be self-evident that I am always the same, unbuttoned, and guileless. Come on, you brown devil, get it firmly into your head. This one needs no special surveillance. He's come here for a quiet life. Imprisonment has taught him something. What's this I must fill in? A questionnaire, of course, and a curriculum vitae. This will open the new file lying ready on the table. Afterward, all tales told against me, all character reports from official persons, will be filed there. And as soon as the outlines of a new case can be roughed out, and the mainland gives a signal to put a few more inside they will put me, there's an adobe jailhouse right here in the backyard, and slap another tenor on me. I hand over the initial documents. The secret police officer peruses them and files them in his loose-leaf folder. "Could you please tell me where the district education department is?" I suddenly ask him, politely and casually. And he politely tells me. His eyebrows do not shoot up in surprise. From this I deduce that I can go and ask for work with no objection from the MGB. As an old prisoner, of course, I did not cheapen myself by asking him outright whether I was allowed to work in the school network. "Can you tell me when I shall be allowed to go there without escort?" He shrugs his shoulders. "Just for today, while you're being... It would be as well if you don't go beyond the gates. But you can pop out on business." And off I walk. I wonder whether everybody knows the meaning of this great free world. I am walking along by myself, with no automatic rifles threatening me from either flank or from the rear. I look behind me. No one there. If I like, I can take the right-hand side past the school fence where a big pig is rooting in a puddle. And if I like, I can walk on the left, where hens are strutting and scratching immediately in front of the district education department. I walk the 200 meters to the department, and my spine, which seemed bent for eternity, is already just a little straighter, my manner already a little more relaxed. In the course of those 200 meters... I have graduated to the next higher civil estate. I go in, wearing an old woolen tunic from my days at the front, and my terribly old, twill trousers. My shoes are camp issue, pigskin, and the obtrusive ends of my underpants are not entirely hidden in them. Two fat Kazakhs sit there, inspectors of the district education department, according to their nameplates. I should like a job in a school, I say, with growing confidence and even a sort of offhandedness, as though I were asking where the water jug was. They prick up their ears. After all, in a Kazakh village out in the desert, new teachers looking for jobs do not arrive every half hour. And although the Kokterek district covers a bigger area than Belgium, they know by sight everyone in it with 7 years of schooling. What did you study? They ask in fairly good Russian. Physics and mathematics at the university. They are quite startled. They exchange glances. They start gabbling in rapid Kazakh. And where have you come from? As though there could be any mystery about it, I have to spell it out for them. What sort of idiot would come to this place looking for a job and in March at that? I got here an hour ago. I'm an exile. They assumed a knowing look and vanished one after the other into the director's office. When they had left, I noticed that the typist, a Russian woman of 50 or so, was looking at me. An instantaneous spark of sympathy. We were compatriots. She, too, was from the archipelago. Where was her home? Why had she been put away? In which year? Nadezhda Nikolaevna Grekova, daughter of a Cossack family in Novocherkassk, arrested in 37, was a simple typist, but the organs had used their whole arsenal to persuade her that she was a member of some fantastic terrorist organization. She had done 10 years, and now she was a repeater, exiled in perpetuity. Lowering her voice and keeping one eye on the director's door, which was ajar, she briefed me succinctly. 2 10-year schools, several 7-year schools. The district was gasping for math teachers, had not a single one with higher education, had never seen a physicist close enough to know what sort of animal he was. A ring from the inner office. In spite of her plumpness, the typist sprang up and hurried in, all eagerness to serve, and on her return summoned me in a loud official voice. There was a red cloth on the table. Both inspectors were sitting very comfortably on a sofa. On a big armchair under a portrait of Stalin sat the director, a Kazakh woman, small, lithe, attractive, with something feline and something serpentine in her manner. Stalin grinned at me malevolently from his frame. They made me sit over by the door, keeping me at a distance as though they were interrogating a prisoner, and began an excruciatingly pointless conversation, which might have been much shorter had they not followed every few sentences to me with a 10-minute conference in Kazakh, while I sat by like a half-wit. They questioned me in detail about where I had taught and when, and expressed their misgivings that I might have forgotten my subject or my teaching technique. Then, after endlessly stalling, endlessly sighing that there were no vacancies, that the schools in the district were chock-full of mathematicians and physicists, that it was difficult to squeeze out even half an extra stipend, that rearing the young in our epoch was a responsible task, they got around to the really important point. What had I done to land in jail? What crime exactly had I committed? The cat-snake screwed up her sly eyes in anticipation, as though the blood-red glare of my crime was already painfully beating on her Bolshevik face. I looked over her head at the sinister features of the Satan who had wrecked my whole life. With his portrait watching me, what could I tell them about our relationship? I used a prison trick to frighten these educators off. What they wanted me to tell them was a state secret, and I had no right to do so. What I wanted to know, without further waste of time, was whether they would take me on. The discussions in Kazakh went on and on. Who would be so bold as to employ a state criminal at his own risk? But they found a way out, making me write a curriculum vitae and complete a questionnaire in 2 copies. Here we go again. Paper can take anything. Surely it was no more than an hour ago that I had filled in these forms. I filled them in yet again and returned to the MGB. I inspected their yard and the homemade prison inside with interest, saw how even they had imitated the grown-ups by quite unnecessarily knocking a little window for parcels in the adobe wall, although it was so low that baskets could be passed over it. Ah, but how can you have an MGB post without a parcels window? I wandered around their yard and found myself breathing much more freely than in the musty district education department. From there, the MGB was an enigma, and the inspector's blood ran cold at the thought of it. But over here, I was at home, with my own ministry. The three dolts of commandants, two of them officers, were quite frankly there to keep watch on us. We were their bread and butter. There was no mystery about it. They were easygoing and allowed us to spend the night not in a locked room, but out in the yard on hay. A night under the open sky, we had forgotten what it was like. There had always been locks and bars, always walls and ceilings. I had no thought of sleep. I walked and walked and walked about the prison service yard, which was bathed in soft, warm light. A cart left where it had been unhitched, a well, a drinking trough, a small hayrick, the black shadows of horses under an open-sided shed. It was all so peaceful, so ancient, so free from the cruel imprint of the MVD. It was only the 3rd of March, but there was not the slightest chill in the night air. It was still almost summery, as it had been in the daytime. Again and again the braying of donkeys rose over the sprawling town of Kokterek, long drawn out and passionate, telling the she-asses of their love, of the ungovernable strength flooding their bodies. Some of the braying was probably the she-asses answering. I found it difficult to distinguish one voice from another, but that powerful bass bellowing was perhaps the noise of camels. I felt that if I only had a voice, I too would start baying at the moon. I shall be able to breathe here. I shall be able to move around. Surely I should break through that paper curtain of forms. With that trumpeting night around me, I felt superior to all those timorous bureaucrats. To teach, to feel myself a man again, to sweep into the classroom and run my burning eyes over childish faces. My finger points to a drawing. They all hold their breath. Given to prove, construction, proof. They all breathe freely again. I cannot sleep. I walk and walk and walk in the moonlight. The donkeys sing their song. The camels sing. Every fibre in me sings. I am free. I am free. In the end, I lie down beside my comrades on some hay under the open-sided shelter, 2 steps away from us. Horses stand at their mangers, peacefully champing hay all night long. Surely there could be no sweeter, no more friendly sound on this our first night of freedom. Champ away, you mild, inoffensive creatures. Next day we were allowed to move into private lodgings. I found myself a hen house to suit my pocket, with a single bleary window and such a low roof that even where it was highest in the middle, I could not stand upright. Give me a low-roofed cottage, I once wrote in prison, dreaming of exile. It was not very pleasant, all the same, not being able to raise my head. Still, it was a little house of my own. The floor was earthen, I put my padded camp vest on it, and there was my bed. But Alexander Klementyevich Zdanyukovich, an exiled engineer who had formerly taught at the Bauman Institute, quickly lent me a couple of wooden boxes on which I managed to make myself comfortable. I had no oil lamp as yet, I had nothing. An exile must select and buy every single thing he needs, as though he has just landed on this earth. But I did not feel the want of it. All those years in our cells and our huts, the state's electricity had seared our souls, and now darkness was bliss. Even darkness can be an element of freedom. In the darkness and the silence, the noise of the loudspeaker on the town square might have reached me, but this was Kokterek, and it had been out of action for 3 days. I simply lay on my boxes and enjoyed it. What more could I desire? But the morning of March the 6th surpassed anything that I could have wished for. Chadova, my elderly landlady, an exile from Novgorod, whispered, because she dared not say it out loud, "Go and listen to the radio. I'm afraid to repeat what I've just heard." Something told me to do as she said. I went over to the central square. A crowd of perhaps 200 people, a lot for Kokterek, huddled around the post under the loudspeaker and the sullen sky. There were many Kazakhs, most of them old men, among the crowd. Their bald heads were bare, and they held their red-brown muskrat fur hats in their hands. They were grief-stricken. The younger people seemed less concerned. 2 or 3 tractor drivers had not removed their caps. Nor, of course, would I. Before I could make out what the announcer was saying, he spoke with a histrionic catch in his voice. Understanding dawned on me. This was the moment my friends and I had looked forward to even in our student days, the moment for which every Zek in Gulag, except the Orthodox communists, had prayed. He's dead. The Asiatic dictator is dead. The villain has curled up and died. What unconcealed rejoicing there would be back home in the special camp. But where I was, Russian girls, schoolteachers, stood sobbing their hearts out. What is to become of us now? They had lost a beloved parent. I wanted to yell at them across the square. Nothing will become of you now. Your fathers will not be shot. Your husbands-to-be will not be jailed. And you will never be stigmatized as relatives of prisoners. I could have howled with joy there by the loudspeaker. I could even have danced a wild jig. But alas, the rivers of history flow slowly. My face, trained to meet all occasions, assumed a frown of mournful attention. For the present, I must pretend. Go on pretending, as before. All the same, my exile had begun with magnificent auguries. Once again, a whole day was devoted to writing a poem, the 5th of March. 10 days passed, and the rival barons, wrangling over portfolios and eyeing each other nervously, abolished the MGB altogether, so that I had been right to doubt whether the MGB was there forever. 6 months later, of course, it was back in the form of the KGB, staffed as before. Injustice, inequality, and slavery apart, is anything forever in this world of ours? Chapter 6. The Good Life in Exile. 1. Bicycle nails, 0.5 kilo. 2. Shoe, 5. 3. Ash pan, 2. 4. Glashes, 10. 5. Fencil case, child's, 1. 6. Glope, 1. 7. Match, 50 boxes. 8. Bat lamp, 2. 9. Tooth past, 8. 10. Gingerbread, 34 kilos. 11. Vodka, 156.5 liters. This was a list of all goods in stock and due for repricing in the general store at the village of Aydarli. Inspectors and stocktakers of the Kokterek District Consumer Cooperative, RIPO, had drawn up the list, and I was now turning the handle of a calculating machine and reducing the prices of some items by 7.5 and of others by 1.5%. Prices were plunging alarmingly, and it was to be expected that both fencil case and glope would be sold before the new school year began, that the nails would find a home in bicycles, and that only the great gingerbread pile, probably pre-war, was on its way down into the category of unsaleable stocks. As for the vodka, even if the price went up, it wouldn't outlast May Day. The price reductions, which according to Stalinist custom took place in time for April the 1st, and by which the toilers gained so many million rubles, the full benefit was calculated and published in advance, hit me hard. By then I had spent a whole month in exile, going through all I had earned in the self-financing foundry at Jezhkazgan, a free man supporting myself on gulag money, and calling regularly at the district education department to try and find out whether they would take me on. But the snake-like director had stopped receiving me. The two fat inspectors could scarcely find time to growl at me, and toward the end of the month I was shown a ruling from the Oblast Education Department that all schools in Kokterek District were fully staffed with math teachers, and that there was no possibility of finding me work. Meanwhile, I had been writing a play, Decembrists Without December. Without having to go through the morning and evening body searches, and with no need to destroy what I had written at short intervals as I used to, I had no other occupation, and after the camp I liked it that way. Once a day I went to the tea room, and ate some hot broth for 2 rubles, the same thin soup they sent out in a bucket for the prisoners in the local jail. Coarse black bread was sold freely in the local shop. I had bought potatoes and even a lump of pork fat. I myself had brought a donkey load of underbrush from the thickets, so that I could light my cooking stove if I liked. My happiness was not far from complete, and I thought to myself, if they won't give me a job, they needn't. While my money lasts, I'll go on writing my play. I may never have so much freedom again. When I was least expecting it, one of the 3 commandants crooked a finger at me in the street. He took me to the Raipo, into the office of the director, a Kazakh as round as a cannonball, and said with solemn emphasis, "The mathematician." What miracle was this? No one asked me why I had been inside, or gave me forms and curricula vitae to fill in. There and then, his secretary, an exiled Greek girl of cinematic beauty, tapped out with one finger an order appointing me a planning officer with a salary of 450 rubles a month. That same day, 2 other unplaced exiles were assigned to the Raipo with just as little formality, with no forms to fill in for leisurely study. Vasilenko, the ocean-going ship's captain, and someone I did not yet know, the very reserved Grigory Samoilovich M. Blank Z. Vasilenko was already nursing a plan to deepen the River Chu, cows could ford it in the summer months, and introduce a motorboat service. He had asked the command post to let him go and survey the channel. Captain Mann, his classmate at navigation school and on the training brig Tovarishch, was just at that time fitting out the Ob for a voyage to the Antarctic. But Vasilenko was packed off to the Raipo as a storeman. But we were not wanted as planners, or storemen, or ledger clerks. All 3 of us were thrown in to deal with an emergency, the repricing of goods. On the night of March 31st to April 1st, year in and year out, the Raipo was in the throes of despair, and there never were and never could be enough people. They had to make an inventory of all the goods, and expose all the thieving salespeople, though not with a view to prosecution, reprice them, and begin trading the very next day at the new prices, which were so very advantageous to the toilers. But the total length of all railways and high roads in our desert district was 0 kilometres, and shops out in the wilds just never could bring these new prices, so advantageous to the toiler, into operation before May the 1st. For a solid month, all shops stopped trading altogether, while the lists were being reckoned up and confirmed by the Raipo and delivered by camel. But in the district centre itself, trade could simply not be disrupted just before May Day. By the time we arrived in the Raipo, 15 people, permanent staff and temporaries, were already working on it. Every desk was sheeted with inventories on rough paper, and nothing could be heard but the clicking of abacuses, on which the expert bookkeepers were both multiplying and dividing, and business-like exchanges of abuse. They sat us down to work at once. I was soon fed up with multiplying and dividing on paper, and I asked for a calculating machine. There wasn't a single one in the Raipo, and anyway, none of them knew how to use such a thing, but someone remembered seeing some sort of gadget with figures in a cupboard at the District Statistics Administration. Only nobody there used it either. They telephoned, went over, and came back with it. I started whirring and quickly jotting down rows of figures, while the senior bookkeepers glowered at me, wondering whether I was a rival. I just turned my handle and thought to myself, how quickly a Zek gets cheeky, or, putting it in literary language, how quickly a man's requirements grow. I was dissatisfied because they had torn me away from the play I was writing in my dark hovel, dissatisfied because they had not given me a job in a school, dissatisfied because they had forced me to what? To dig in frozen soil? To mix mud for bricks with my bare feet in icy water? No, they had forcibly put me at a clean desk to turn the handle of a calculating machine and enter figures in columns. At the beginning of my time in the camps, if they had ordered me to do this blissful work 12 hours a day without pay for as long as I was inside, I should have been beside myself with joy. As it was, they were paying me 450 rubles for it. I should be able to drink a liter of milk every day, and I was turning my nose up and wanting more. The repo had been bogged down in the repricing exercise for a week. Each item had to be put in the right category for the overall price reduction, then reclassified for the rural price differential. And still not a single shop could begin trading. Then the obese chairman, who beat all the rest for idleness, assembled us all in his purely ceremonial office and said, "Right, listen, according to the latest findings of medical science, nobody needs 8 hours sleep. 4 hours are absolutely adequate. So these are my orders. You'll start work at 7 a.m., finish at 2 a.m., 1 hour's break for dinner, and one for supper." As far as I could tell, not one of us was amused, rather than awed, by this stupefying outburst. We all shrank into ourselves, said nothing, plucked up our courage only to discuss the best time for the supper break. This was it, the exile's lot of which I had been warned. It was made up of orders like this. All those sitting there were exiles trembling for their jobs. If they were dismissed, it would be a long time before they found anything else in Koh Tere. And anyway, it was not for the director personally, it was for the country. It had to be done. They even thought the latest findings of medical science quite reasonable. Oh, how I longed to get up and jeer at that self-satisfied hog, to relieve my feelings just for once. But that would have been anti-Soviet agitation, pure and simple, inciting people to sabotage an operation of major importance. You go through life from stage to stage, schoolboy, student, citizen, soldier, prisoner, exile. And it is always the same. The bosses are always too heavy, too strong for you, and you must bow down and keep silent. If he had said until 10 in the evening, I would have stayed. But he was ordering us to face bloodless execution, ordering me in this place where I was free to stop writing. Oh, no, to hell with you and with the price reductions. My camp experience suggested a way out, not to answer back, but quietly to do the opposite. I tamely listened to the order with the rest of them, but at 5 o'clock I rose from my desk and left. And I did not return until 9 in the morning. All my colleagues were already sitting there, counting or pretending to count. They looked at me as though I were crazy. M. Blank Z, who secretly approved of my behavior, but dared not imitate me, informed me privately that the boss had stood over my empty desk screaming that he would drive me 100 kilometers into the desert. I admit that my heart was in my boots. The MVD could, of course, do anything. They could easily chase me out there. 100 kilometers, why not? And I would have seen the last of the district center. But I was born lucky. I had landed on the archipelago after the war, missing the most lethal period. And now I had arrived in exile after Stalin's death. In the past month, something new had crept through even to our local MVD command. Almost imperceptibly, a new time was beginning, the mildest 3 years in the history of the archipelago. The chairman did not summon me or come to see me. I finished the day's work, still fresh, with dozing and delirious people all around me, and decided to leave at 5 in the evening again. I didn't care how it ended, as long as it was quick. How often in my life have I observed that a man can safely sacrifice a great deal as long as he clings to the essential? The play, which I had been carrying within me, even in the special camp, at hard labor, I refused to sacrifice, and I triumphed. For a whole week they all worked nights, and they got used to my empty desk. Even the chairman just looked the other way when he passed me in the corridor. But it was not my destiny to bring order into the rural cooperatives of Kazakhstan. A young Kazakh, head of a teaching department, suddenly appeared in the Raipo. Until I appeared, he had been the only university graduate in Koh Tere, and very proud of it. My arrival, however, did not arouse his envy. Whether he wanted to reinforce his school before the first batch of pupils took their final exam, or to vex the snake-like director of the education department, I don't know. But he ordered me to bring your diploma along quickly. I ran home like a schoolboy to fetch it. He put it in his pocket and went off to a trade union conference in Jambul. 3 days later, he looked in again and laid before me an extract from an order made by the Oblast Education Department. This book is continued on cassette 13, side 1.